Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at kosai.org.
If scary movies give you dread, keep you up late night in bed, here's a podcast that will help you ease your mind. We'll explain the plot real nicely, then we'll talk about what's frightening so you never have to have a spooky time. It's Ruined.
Oh, hello. Welcome to Ruined.
I'm Allison.
And I'm Hallie. And this is a podcast. We ruin a horror movie just for you.
Hallie, how are you?
I don't know, Allison. I think like everyone else, I'm being torn apart at an atomic level. We're just reading the news. It's just unfortunate that we are headed back to the 80s. We already lost Roe, and now they're...
I mean, we could wish for the 80s at this point.
Girl, you're...
Like the 1880s.
Oh, boy. You're not wrong about that. Yeah, it is funny watching these. At least, of course, we're doing March Madness Month, and
yes.
We are...
Fitting.
A lot of descent into madness, and it is funny, again, as a queer woman, how easy... It's like, well, I would be in a facility, I think, if at some point, you know, if... There's a lot of that in our past.
I think just for being a writer, we would have ended up in facilities.
A woman who could control a pen? Oh my God.
No, that's witchcraft. Put her in a hospital. But yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and it's just sort of, and we've talked about this on the podcast before, obviously, but yeah, well, it's just sort of like America thinks of itself as an exceptional country, and we are in fact going to be like most countries in the world, I would say, which is the government no longer cares what we want. Like, the government conducts its own business, and we have to sort of just live our lives on the ground. And I guess that is simply the way things are going to be. I'm talking this week about IVF and surrogacy and everything. And
I would also say the day-to-day of knowing that overwhelmingly people do not want to fund a genocide.
Yes. And that thing is like, it goes hand in hand where it's like, the people in power can only imagine control and can only forgive those who also exert that control. Like, that seems fine to them, right?
Yeah.
So the people in charge, like, it seems fine to give infinite amount of money to Israel to wage a genocide because, you know, Mike Johnson and his friends, they might say they're pro-life, but they're excited for people to live in hell, you know? Like, they're excited to bring to bear, to force people to live the lives that they want them to live. And again, I don't know. I feel like in the past, I would have just been like, I would have been nihilistic about it because we keep doing this. And I just feel like the only way past this is, and as we've talked a million times, a truly unprecedented optimism, especially also because, like, media is collapsing. It's like, well, you know, it's like, well, if it's everything at once, then at least we could all be acknowledging it's everything at once. I don't have any solutions. Yeah. I want to be clear.
No solutions.
But I just wanted to be, we know, and we're talking about it with you, and hopefully this is a little respite. Of course, we'll be screaming at those things. But it's just a cacophony of like, oh, well, read this, to decompress. Oh, Vice is ending. Okay, well, I guess websites don't exist. And I've said this before, but it's like the jobs I did in my 20s that you could like cobble together, like having two roommates and living, whatever. But it's like you could live. They literally don't exist.
Yeah, you can't like be a freelance writer. You can't be a journalist. You can't like do that kind of creative work.
Yeah.
And like ascend through a pathway of like this kind of corner of, media and entertainment. Because none of the places that we did those things for exist anymore.
Yeah, and we've talked a little bit like venture capital and private equity, but it's like, but it is true. And if it's true about the industries that we know and talk about it, I'm sure in every other industry you're having the exact same fucking problem. I just have like, what other jobs there? Teacher? Oh no, I'm sure that's bad. Working in medicine? I'm sure that's insane.
Awful.
Yeah, like And
have you considered being the CEO of a corporation? That seems to be a job that you could still have.
But then you've got to be insane. And it's like,
I don't want to do, like,
they're just,
I just don't want to work, I guess, at the end of the day. And I don't think anyone should have to.
There is something in all this that it's like, well, but aren't we meant to be just wandering around the woods? You know, obviously.
Yeah, picking berries and petting dogs.
And that's not to fantasize like, oh, that is like an automatically like equal or just or moral way
to
live. But rather like, boy, we really screwed the pooch on making our version of a livable reality, which, of course, is like white American capitalism. It's like, well, it wasn't that, so it has to be something else. Because if that was what it was, we fucked up. So we should not be in charge of this.
No, it definitely wasn't being on Slack at night. Like, that's not what we were built for.
The lean in of it all, especially as women, where you're like, they got us.
Fuck Sheryl Sandberg.
They got all of us, but it's like, the last era where it's like, well, just lean into a system that will punish you and won't exist in 5 years, and you'll give up your whole life and you'll make nothing of note. And like, it's like, why would we have leaned into that? But that's, of course, you know, I mean, and that's like every marginalized group, obviously, where it's just like, wait, what were we doing? Why were we agreeing with this?
Right.
Again, I don't know though how to bring literally my list of like to do bring back media, bring back journalism. We need it. But I mean, I guess unfortunately that's like every time this happens in history, it's like, oh yeah, journalism and the media is collapsing at the same time as these religious people are gaining traction state to state. Right. That's what has happened.
That education is being decimated, so people can't even understand the like little media that there is. And there's and like now we're in this like new insane age where it's like, I can't tell if something is real or not anymore.
Oh, girl.
Like,
I know,
like media literacy, like you show someone a video and like now every video I see, even if I took it, I'm like, is this AI?
I
like,
know.
I don't know. And is this a deep fake of my cat?
And I feel like for me, when I can't tell, I can feel my brain being like, then I can't deal with this. And it's like, no,
exactly.
We have to. And again, do we have solutions to this? We do not. But we just want to talk about it because we know that if we're dealing with it, you are dealing with it.
Yeah. We're all struggling, and it's also like a strange place to be where you're like, I'm struggling a lot, like mentally, financially, and I'm in an extremely cushy position and a privileged position.
Absolutely.
In comparison to, I would say, 99.5% of the people that live in America.
Yeah, absolutely.
It just like makes my brain melt out of my ears.
Yeah, and I think it is on us, and like this is sort of what we're all going to have to be doing, but especially people who have privilege like we do, is like, we have to then, like, whoever is leading what we're doing next, we have to be supporting it. It's just sort of like, how do we find that? What is the group? If you're part of a group and you think, please, you know, read up on our group and see if this stuff interests you, just send it to us.
Yeah, we'll see.
Because it's sort of, you know, I mean, here I'm thinking of like political candidates, but like even that's like almost too limited, you know, a framework to look at it.
Mutual aid and grassroots community stuff and like just starting, I don't know, whenever like things feel deeply overwhelming. And I feel like this year they're going to be so awful
as we approach
November.
Yeah,
like, I mean, I like,
well,
sometimes I'm like, just shoot them both in the head at this point.
I mean, listen, I didn't say it. Well, my concern is they're simply going to turn to dust. Like, I am concerned.
Yeah.
That
I don't even think we have to, like, stop them. I think time might do that, but it is, like,
comes for us all, Allison.
Really brutal moment. But whenever I feel, like, super stressed at, like, a kind of a more zoomed out, like, national and global level, I'm always like, what can I do in my neighborhood to make sure that I'm, like, helping? I've been, like, carrying a lot more cash and small bills on me for the folks who live
nearby.
And I'm like, because I never have cash. I'm always like, or I have like hundreds I got paid with. And I'm like, I don't really know what to do with these.
Being thoughtful in that way, like living in LA too, where it's like nobody carries cash. Like and how quickly that happened and like how devastating that would be to people who lived off that.
Yes.
Yeah. I think it's just, keeping in mind that like our obligation is to be our local communities. Mm-hmm. And we will do that as well. And we'll tell you about it as we do it.
Yeah.
Because I don't know what else the fuck you... I was talking to my mom. And she's like, I got to go to a meeting. I got to do something. I'm like, I feel the same way. So let's all do it.
My parents and I have had similar conversations where I'm like, okay, well, at least... Like, it also, like, you know, for my... If I'm in a position of comfort, my parents are in an even greater one as, like, boomers with a home and all that stuff. And when I hear them be like, I don't know what we're going to do about all this, I'm, like, relieved that at least they feel it.
Yeah. And I have a lot of, I don't know, like, again, like, our parents raised us to be successful in the systems that existed. And not to, not to do it without questioning it, but to also sort of, there's just a presumption that certain things are just the way they are. And I'm grateful that this, what this will hopefully evoke in all of us is, no, that's simply not true. And it can't be true. Like, literally, there's no way how will people live?
No, we can't, this can't keep going, that's for sure.
Rent? My God.
There's going to be like 18 old rich white men, and then the rest of us are going to be dead.
Sorry, my brassiere is falling out.
Of what?
Yeah.
Of your of your boots?
It's falling upwards out of my... for some reason, it's coming up out of my shirt.
Oh. Is it hooked in the back, or is it just kind of like resting atop?
You know, actually, it's a bra that, if anyone here has big boobs, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. They're just... I feel like we're past it, but there was a time where you, if you had big boobs, you could only get a bra that looks medicinal. And I used to have a joke. I've talked about it, but it's like, I had a joke where it's like, oh, like every bra I have sounds like looks like I found it on the grounds of an abandoned insane asylum.
Yes.
Which is perfect because—
I feel like I remember you saying that on stage.
This is the perfect movie for that because it takes place on the grounds of an abandoned insane asylum.
Look at us having segues.
Guys, it's us, Hallie.
And Allison.
For the future. And we're here to tell you about a live show we're about to do. It's Sunday, March 24th.
It's at 7 p.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. Pacific, as normal.
And the movie we're doing is Imaginary. Ooh! Ooh. So please join us. You can get your ticket at moment.co/ruined. As always, we're going to have a drinking game.
Chat up and running. We'll have our old merch.
You better believe we have our old merch, baby.
We don't have new merch.
We never not have our old merch.
We are working on it, but we'll have a new movie, Imaginary, and all of the fun that we normally have at our live shows. So get those tickets at moment.co/ruined. If you're a top-tier Patreon member, you will get your tickets day of in your email, and that is it.
Thank you, guys.
We have to go back to the future.
Bye.
We love you. Bye.
So let us begin. This week's movie is Session 9, which I had, of course, always heard of. It's on, like, every list. And I had never watched it. And I think there's some movies that I feel badly that I haven't seen, or that I sort of feel like, I mean, God, I've seen so many movies. But, like, certain movies, I'm like, oh, I've seen it. And I do think, like, I've now this perspective. Every time I see a horror movie, it was the right time to see it. Does that make sense?
I think that's a nice way of thinking about things. Otherwise, it's like there are so many movies.
There's just no way.
It is like it's just overwhelming to be like, it's a full-time job.
Yeah.
I mean, it is our job. Like, it is literally your job, but like also like it's a job to like stay on top of art that gets created when there's this many, you know, places to make it.
So this is directed by Brad Anderson, who also co-wrote the screenplay with Steven Gavidan. And let me just say, Brad Anderson, he has sort of an interesting filmography. He did The Machinist with Christian Bale. Mm-hmm. He has also done a number of rom-coms, including Happy Accidents, which I remember, God, I'm trying to, I don't know if I saw it, but I remember seeing the trailer for this. 2000, it was a rom-com starring Marissa Tomei and Vincent D'Onofrio.
Oh, okay. Love Marissa Tomei.
Yeah, and I want to go back and revisit it because Session 9 was great. So I was like, oh, well, maybe his rom-coms are great. He clearly has good comedic instincts. And another one called Next Stop Wonderland.
That sounds like vaguely familiar without me knowing anything about it.
Yes. And, okay, they meet on a train, looks like, at the Wonderland Station in Massachusetts. Oh, and Session 9 also takes place in Massachusetts, specifically Danvers, Massachusetts, specifically at the Danvers State Hospital, which was also known as the State Lunatic Hospital at Danvers, the Danvers Lunatic Asylum, and Danvers State Insane Asylum, back when you used to call things that.
Yeah. It's so funny. I saw it in the trailer, which I know we're about to talk about, but like, it's so, like, the way that language evolves, like, when you see something that's like lunatic asylum, I'm like, I use the word lunatic to describe, like, somebody at a grocery store who's like buying weird stuff and like being weird and not in a mental health way,
right.
Like just like about somebody's behavior that's annoying. And it's like so strange that it's like, no, that was like technically a medical diagnosis at a certain time in our history. And then I'm like this maniac over here. And it's like, yeah, that's a guy that kills people. That's what we use that word for in the past.
Well, I also think like a lot of that was like a person who killed someone, but now we would understand is having severe psychosis,
yes.
And they had
yes,
no
yes.
understanding of it whatsoever.
Of what was happening. Yeah.
Yeah, but I do agree, like how I really try to not say crazy and insane as much as I do, but God, it's just such evocative words. But I do think we just need to all work together to come up with better words. And I like absurd, yeah. You know, like there's certain...
Yeah, thesaurus. Wild is a... I like using wild. Like, that was wild.
Yes. I think eventually we'll get there. Maybe, you know, it might just take us a minute. But I love that it was set at an actual space and then they use details about it. Much like how I love when people go to their local library to look something up. I every detail they brought up about Danvers State Hospital, I like looked it up. And it's like, this is on the National Register of Historic Places, you know, just like, this is, you know, like, it was in 1984. So I appreciated mm-hmm. the attention to detail and just a little sprinkle so it makes it seem more realistic, right?
Yes, I like that.
We always like to have Allison watch the trailer. And what did you think about the trailer for Session 9, Allison?
I can't quite figure out what they're doing. Like, at first I was like, oh, they're contractors and they're tearing down the building. And then I was like, no, they seem a little more involved in its history, so perhaps that's not what's happening. But very spooky. Like, I mean, it is just, like, a classic spooky, scary, like, abandoned mental hospital from the 1850s. Like, that is always going to be scary.
Right, yeah.
I like that.
I think you're pretty dead on with your assessment of what those guys are up to. We always like to take a baseline scary. Allison, how scary would it be to have to remove asbestos from an abandoned mental institution?
I mean, very mm-hmm. on a lot of fronts.
Yeah.
Like, do you think there's like an extra, like, is there like a pay scale for like how fucked up a place is if you're doing construction work on it? Like, if it's a, do you think there's like an extra, like an overtime type fee if it's like
Allison,
haunted?
Not for haunting, but they do get a bonus for this job. And I was like, yeah, I would need a bonus to get.
I would need a bonus. If I was just like somebody who regularly worked on like parking garages and office buildings and they were like, do you mind getting the asbestos out of the old loony bin back here? Don't worry, there aren't good. Like, I'd be like, oh, well, for more money.
Right, yeah, if you pay me $1 million.
Yes.
But again, I did something that I thought this movie from like what I knew of it was like a very, it's going to be much more like cynical and cold and maybe more like hostily. I think just because maybe of the setting, I thought like the visuals of it. But it's actually a, like, psychological... It is a horror movie, but, like, it has more of a psychological drama to it.
I like that.
That I really enjoyed. And I was like, oh, that makes me want to watch those rom-coms. And then, finally, would you like to guess the twist in Session 9? And, yes, there is a proper twist in this film.
Ooh.
Guess the twist.
I'm going to guess that one of the guys on the crew is actually a ghost.
Ooh, okay.
But none Allison of them know it until better. They start being like, meow, 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 getting in there.
Look better and better at guessing every single day.
I'm learning, but also not.
Yeah. Well, it's like getting in you on like an emotional level, right? Like it's like,
yes.
you don't know it consciously, but it's like when you train a dog. Like we've trained you to.
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Listen. We are both human golden retrievers, if you've ever met them. So
I'm more of a basset, but
okay. All dogs are good. And all dogs go to heaven.
Yeah. That's true.
And unfortunately, I will say this. Well, whatever. We'll get to it. In case you're sensitive about animal deaths, there is a dog that does go to heaven in this film. So if you don't want to hear skip it. And I say this only because recently I was thinking about having Naomi Paragon on and not being conscious of the fact that the movie we did with her does have a pet death, and she couldn't have been more distraught. So I just want to flag that.
Sure.
Other than that, any other problems you have, you're just going to have to figure it out.
Well, Riz is never going to die, so it doesn't affect me in that way.
Exactly. Well, he's certainly not going to die before you. I mean, we could all agree on that.
Yeah, definitely not.
All right. Well, with that in mind, let us please ruin Session 9. All right, so we open on, and this is a shot that is in the trailer. It's on the cover if you look up the movie. It is a old-timey wheelchair, so it has little wheels at the bottom.
Okay.
Sort of like a hospital wheelchair versus a standard or, you know, a more modern wheelchair. Mm-hmm. And it is upside down in the hallway of an abandoned building that we're obviously going to find out is the Danvers State Hospital. And the image slowly flips right side up, telling us things are going to be a little unexpected. Okay, things are going to be not as they seem, Allison. We see a man sitting in the driver's side of a very messy car. And there's a lot of, like, excellent shots where he's looking at the radio. And the radio keeps changing. And so you're not sure, oh, is that in his head? Is he hearing a change? And then we hear somebody talking to him in the passenger seat. And we pull back and we see his friend, played by David Caruso, is also in the car with him.
Sure.
But a lot of great, like, immediately putting you off, like, putting you on your hind feet about, like, oh, wait, what am I listening to, which I love. And, of course, the man listing, his name is Gordon, and he owns an asbestos cleanup crew. And it's printed on the side, he has a bright red van. And so, basically, they are hired to different jobs. This is, like, a huge job, obviously, like, this is going to be, basically, they have different companies come in, assess what they could do, how much money, how much time, and then they all put in a bid. And from what I understand, they don't know what the bids are beforehand, right?
They don't know what other bids
yes.
are.
So I will say there's a lot of discussion about running an asbestos cleanup business, which I thought was interesting, and I seemed...
It's nice to have that info, you know? You never know when you're going to need it.
So his passenger, his friend Phil, who has worked with him presumably forever, is asking him about the baby. So Gordon just had a baby named Emma with his wife Wendy, and the baby is old enough to have a christening, but I think we're going to think under a year old. So little bitty baby. Gordon is exhausted. And as all parents of infants are, and says, yes. It's just been really hard. Emma still has that ear infection. Gordon's like, oh, she's had it since the christening. He's like, I know. It's been really, I've been exhausted. Wendy's been exhausted. It's just been really hard. But, I mean, we've all heard that. So, again, it's like, what weight should we give this, you know, starting out the way that we do? I also want to say the guy who plays Gordon is Peter Mullen. He's so good in this. I think
that name is really familiar. Yeah.
He's a Scottish actor and his accent does come in and out, which is fun, but like
very fun.
It doesn't matter to me. Like, it's like he's an excellent actor and I thought he really crushed this role. Oh yeah, he's been in a ton of British stuff. Check him out. Gordon, but we're already thinking, like, he's kind of sleepy, he's kind of slow, so then it's like when things start to maybe, he's not sure what's real and what's not, we've already established there are factors at play that maybe he's not on his game like he normally would be, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Phil's a nice guy, and he's like, well, let me know if you need anything. Obviously, I love you and Wendy. Like, you know, just let me know. I'll help out. And they are, of course, seated outside the Massachusetts abandoned Danvers State Hospital. A security guard joins them. And he says, oh, Billy Griggs is almost there. He's from the county or the city, I think from the city. And he is going to do a walkthrough with them, explain the bidding process and that kind of thing. And Billy knows Gordon, because I imagine whatever state you're in, there aren't that many asbestos cleanup guys, right? For Massachusetts, like, I'm sure there's like the handful really that gets handful. Everything, especially for something that this is intense. Like, you wouldn't want to do this with someone who just started.
No, you would need, and like, yes. I'm sure there's like a lot of specific, like, expensive equipment and like a lot of like safety and health kind of like protocol that you would need to know. So,
yeah. So they're getting called in because they are experts, because they can do this kind of level of work. That being said, they just do seem like guys from Massachusetts. So, they're not approaching this level of science. It's like they're regular guys. This is like Gordon's business. And they happen to have worked together a long time. Phil says, you know, I'm going to be honest, like, so this place has been closed since 1985, so it's been 15 years. And he says, if the place has been closed that long, why are you up here and why do they have you carrying a gun? And the guard...
Great question.
Yeah, and the guard tells him, well, you know, a lot of patients, like, lived here for years and then were basically unceremoniously dumped, so a lot of people actually come back here. And I'm like, that makes sense. Like, I'm sure it'd be a traumatic place to live, but also if you spent years living there, it would be a home. You know, and also, if you're a mentally ill person who's dumped out of institution, you might be homeless. So the idea of, like, returning that, I think that makes sense. And he's basically...
Wait, how long ago did it close, did they
15
say?
Years.
Oh, 15.
So it's been a long time, but like the patients would still be alive, a lot of them, right?
Yeah. I was thinking 50.
Right. No. Yeah, it's much more recent. And basically the city is, this guy, we'll meet Billy in a minute. Again, yeah. There's a lot of like asbestos-related conversation that I thought was fascinating. I loved it.
I mean, I would love to know more about it.
And he says to them, like, I can't imagine coming back here if I was them. I'd rather be homeless. But then again, I'm not nuts. Well,
okay.
Not yet, anyways. The car arrives with Billy Griggs from the city, and they follow him in. And once they get there, Gordon tells Phil that he heard that Environmental Solutions and American Yankee already came last week and put in their bids. So they're the last company. And Gordon is basically like, I know American Yankee, they put in a bid to do it fast with a low price point. So now Gordon's like, how are we going to get this? How fast can we do this and at what price? And they sort of argue what to do because Phil's like, look at this place. It's going to take weeks. Like, there's no way. Like, please do not lowball us specifically with the time. Like, it's just going to be impossible, right? But Gordon's like, Phil, I've known you for years. Just trust me on this. I know what to do. They get to the hospital. It's gigantic. It's red brick, four stories, like brick columns in the front. Stunning. And Bill Griggs gives them a tour. These are all actual facts. You know, he's like, oh, this is a Kirkbride building named after Thomas Kirkbride. And there's basically, he said it's shaped like a giant bat. So the main staff building is the body. And then it has two wings. One's the women's wing and one's the men's wing. And they sort of start walking through. And as they do, we find out, the building is on the National Historic Register, so they wouldn't let Bill. Bill wants the city to tear it down and actually use the land. Like, the land's the most valuable thing. And it's kind of worth it to clean house and use these buildings again, knowing they've been sitting here 15 years, or level it? Mm. But the town manager has basically overruled Bill, and he wants to just reuse the buildings as they exist, which I get because they're beautiful historic buildings, but then what that requires is an insane amount of rehabbing the interiors
and
everything.
It might be easier to just have a new building.
Yeah, and they're walking through, and it has, like, all these old-timey, like, it has a hydrotherapy room, and Phil says, what is this? And it's a big tank full of stagnant water. And Bill's saying, like, yeah, I...
Why is the water still there?
Yeah, it looks like they just left a bunch of stuff there. Like, it's full of furniture, it's full of files, which, again, you think they wouldn't do, but, again, I wouldn't be surprised, if something like this gets shut down. He said, they used to do hydrotherapy. It was kind of, like, cutting edge when they first built this stuff. And Danvers is actually the place where they perfected the prefrontal lobotomy. This will, of course, come in handy later.
I would guess it might.
Yeah. As they move on, Bill says, the facility was built as its own self-contained town. So we've got a movie theater, a bowling alley, a church, and there's a cemetery on the grounds, but they only labeled the graves by number, which I thought was so disgusting. Because it's like, their names.
So gross.
You're just right.
It's not that you don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
You know.
You're just too lazy to get a actual headstone that spells it out. But again, that does seem like what humans do is we'll just give you a number and, you'll be back there. They walk on. Each wing is made up of four wards A, B, and C. Ward A, he says, where they keep the, quote, most extreme patients, people with psychosis. And they turn down a dark hall. And while Bill and Phil sort of walk on talking, Gordon turns and sees the wheelchair we saw in the opening shot.
Okay.
And he has a moment where it startles him, and you see this look of recognition. Allison, the light dips in the hallway, and a man's voice says to him, "Hello, Gordon." And then Phil calls for him, and Gordon sort of snaps out of it.
Ooh.
And Phil says, "Come on."
Not great.
And it's too early to say, what would you do? But there will be another moment. Because to me, that would be
I want to take the job.
I'd be like, a man talked to me out of the hallway and it was a ghost. So I got to go home. Like, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I can't work here. So bye-bye.
But we do
find new asbestos rooms.
Yeah, but we do find Gordon, like, basically needs this job, like, in order to keep the business going.
Right.
While it is both a specialized work that you do get paid a lot of money for, you're not getting called every week, I'm sure.
Right. It's like it's not regular maintenance being done.
Exactly. Yeah, you're not a plumber. This is something, and you have the investment in the equipments. So they walk on, they walk through the solarium, they walk to, quote, Danvers Town Hall. It's like this big room. And Phil says, okay, I'm looking at it. I have some bad news. The ceiling tiles are from the 40s, which means those things are absolutely full of asbestos. If I were you, I would go and seal this off, bring in neg air machines, which I'm assuming means like just keeping it out of the air, and then set up a recon shower. Basically, like, when we're going to have to come in and out of here, we're going to be covered in asbestos dust. And his main concern is, like, not bringing it to their homes. But obviously, you know, he says, this shit gets everywhere when we start pulling it out of the ceiling. So we're going to have a whole setup. So again, that's expensive.
Yeah.
And we see Gordon cut off a piece of the fallen ceiling tile and bag it, presumably. I'm like, I don't know if they're going to test it for asbestos or he'll look at it later. But obviously, it's full of asbestos, as it turns out. And Bill says, okay. So just level with me. OSHA won't even let me get started on, like, construction until you guys do your pass. I need that pass to be done by Columbus Day for the construction crews to come here. Is that possible? We don't know the date, but apparently this is going to be in a pinch.
Okay.
And Gordon says, I would say these rooms, the dining room, the tunnels. There's also tunnels underneath that they will have to be.
Of course there's You got to have tunnels.
And he says, I would say, and Phil butts in and says, it's going to be 3 weeks minimum. There's no way we're doing this in less than 3 weeks. Yeah. Gordon says, we could do it in two. He needs the job. Okay. And Phil's face falls because it's like, if we do it in two, those are going to be 2 weeks where it sucks shit. Like, you're going to have, where can you get here at dawn?
Rough.
And work, yeah, it's going to be horrible.
Till midnight, yeah.
And Bill says, well, all right then, 2 weeks. But as they walk, as they start to leave the building, Gordon looks into one of the patient rooms. And he calls them over and says, what is this? And we see on every surface of the walls, there is cutout magazine pictures and photos. And Bill says, oh, you know, this room is used for seclusion, solitary confinement. It looks like it's some sort of art therapy from the 70s. You know, it looks like a patient put this up. And Gordon sees this photo of a mom and a baby and it, you know, like affects him as a father. Yes. Once they get outside, Phil realizes he left his bag in that last patient room and runs back to get it. And now that they're alone, Bill, you know, Bill's like, congratulations on your new baby. Me and Elizabeth are so excited for you. Apparently she's the town historian, which is why Bill knows all the stuff about Danvers. And Gordon takes out a baby photo from his wallet to show him. And baby Emma is adorable. And he's like, well, while Phil's inside, we'll match Yankee's bid and we'll do it in a week. I don't run an asbestos removal service, but just from walking through them, like, there's no, maybe if we had 100 guys.
You couldn't vacuum that building. Right,
exactly. Like, it's not even like, even if you had 100 guys, it just would be the hours in the day compared to what you're fixing, right? Like, it doesn't seem like possible.
There's an amount of time that is non-negotiable for tasks.
Yes, yeah.
Like, it just, it, like, some specific thing, like, it just takes this long to do 1 square foot.
Yeah.
No matter how many people you have, if you all simultaneously, like, it still, like, takes time.
Yeah, and it's like the, and, like, the equipment and the, you know, like, setting up the retcon showers. I'm like, a week? But Gordon, again, he's, you know, sticking to his guns, mm-hmm. and he's going to make it happen. And Bill's like, well, you know, I can't tell you what they put in, but look, I mean, I would love to give it to you, so you just let me know by Friday, you know, and we'll let you know. Because basically, like, they'll know by... If they let them know by Friday, then they'll start on Monday. And so mm-hmm. Gordon's like, you will not be disappointed. We can do this in 1 week. Again, talking out of his ass because he needs this job, right? And we've all done that before, obviously.
Of course.
He says, I have 4 great guys. I'm going to hire 1 more. That's 5 guys. I really need this job. Bill's like, okay.
It doesn't seem like enough guys.
Not by a long shot. They should have 50 guys in there.
50 guys.
But of course, Bill says, okay, I'm going to take you in consideration. Just submit your bid. Back at home, we see Gordon sitting in the car, and he's looking at photos of baby Emma across the street. And then he goes and he looks up, and he stares into the front yard. He sees Wendy pick Emma up out of the front yard, and they see their little dog tied up. And she looks at Gordon, and she kind of shrugs sadly and walks in the front door. And we can see on the front stovetop, there's a big pot of boiling water. She's making dinner, and the dog's going nuts running around. And Gordon sort of sighs when he sees this. And then we look and he sees his bag is full of flowers and champagne. Allison, they have won the bid. They have won, which means the next week he's going to be ass deep in asbestos. And I think
and goes.
He also has like Oreos and peanut butter and like treats and groceries. So I think it was sort of like a, hey, you're not going to see me the next week. So I'm going to bring you some nice stuff.
I'm going to butter you up with some junk food.
Yeah, and- let's celebrate. You're going to be alone with a baby. I'm going to be covered in asbestos dust, you know. But we go inside, or we walked as he walks inside, and we hear a woman's voice, essentially Wendy, say, "Roses? Why, they're lovely. What's the occasion, Gordon?" And then a woman's screaming, and a machine starts up. The machine, of course, is a generator outside the hospital. It is time to get in there and start ripping out the asbestos. On the screen, it says Monday. So our first day.
Oh, boy. We're
on the
job. I like that.
Yeah.
I like that.
They've strung lights down in the tunnels. Everywhere they go, like, is covered in powder. And I was like, is all that powder potentially asbestos? Like, how do you know if the powder is... But I guess you don't. So they have, like painter's masks. They also have, like, full-on what look like gas masks. In certain areas, they wear full hazmat suits. And I was terrified because I see this person who I don't know his name yet. He's the one setting up the generator. He's in a mask and white hazmat suit. I'm like, if they're all in hazmat suits, I'm going to have to bail. I can't summarize this movie because I can't tell.
No.
They're all white guys, like, of a route. Well, except one guy's younger. But, like, I was like, I can't tell who's who when 95% of their face is covered up.
Yeah, even if it wasn't.
Yeah. And luckily for me, they do kind of play a little fast and loose, and that's just a movie. You know what I mean? You can't, yeah. In reality, I'm sure the second they step in there, they are masked. And yeah. Especially now.
Yeah, but we need to, like, at least know who exactly. Is talking and, like, what's happening.
So this is their employee, Hank. Hank has worked with Gordon for about 5 years. He's not the most reliable guy, but he's really good at his job. So he's kind of something where, like, they let it slip that he's a little bit unreliable. Gordon sort of lays out everything that needs to be done and ends with, and I need you marking the ducts and the tunnels with green slime, which is what they call green. Like, it's like temporary paint.
Paint.
And yeah. Hank's like, well, don't you mean red? Because they're a biohazard. And Gordon goes, oh, yeah, that's what I meant. That's what I meant. Again. Uh-oh,
somebody's already
exactly
distracted.
I said, Allison, clearly he's distracted. Exactly.
Look at us on the same page.
We also find out that Hank is currently fucking Phil's ex-girlfriend, who he stole from Phil. And he says to Phil, because he's such an asshole, where it's like, if you stole the partner, you're not allowed to be the asshole. And he goes up to Phil and says, Amy says hi.
Okay.
Absolutely not.
No.
And Phil storms off, but also this is their job. Like, they, like, okay, I'm going to have to deal with you. Well, but why be an asshole, you know?
It's so funny because, like, I think often about, like, the drama within, like, the comedy community or the entertainment industry. And there's always, you know, couples that break up and cheating rumors and all that. But it's like, that does happen in any community.
Yeah.
And it's so funny that it's like, ooh, there's a lot of drama going on in the asbestos removal industry in Boston right now, like in Massachusetts. Like,
no, that's so true. Yeah, like every
like
industry.
It's not like glamorous and sexy, but it's still happening.
Listen, people still out here. They're out. Everyone's still having sex.
Everyone's having sex. People need to fuck. It really doesn't matter what you do for your job.
Yeah. Over the dining room, we meet another of Gordon's longtime employees, Mike. He's been with Gordon for 5 years, and then the fifth guy he hired is Jeff, who is Gordon's nephew. He has never done this before. Phil does not like this at all. But is sort of trying not to be a crank about it. And Jeff's, I think he's supposed to be like college age. Like a real sweetheart, but kind of a dumbass. Mm-hmm. You know, like just being goofy. And Mike says, hey, just, you know, your uncle is great. He's not a slave driver, but I am. So you better not be doing drugs on the job. Jeff said, don't worry about it. I'm not going to do that. And Jeff plugs in a boombox. He starts blasting rock. Hank immediately starts yelling at him. When he walks in and says, do not play that. It creates vibrations that make asbestos dust slough off of surfaces and into the air. And then we inhale it. So if you want to play music, you have to play something like Yanni or John Tesh that doesn't actually create reverberations in the space.
Oh,
I'm like, that's interesting John too. Tesh. I know. What a time capsule. I guess even 2000.
It's like, well, you couldn't play the video of him doing the NBA on NBC theme live at the Red Rocks because it has the bouncing basketball at the beginning.
It's so good. And then there's also an SNL sketch where
yes, it's so
Tim
good.
Robinson and
basketball.
Yeah, Will Ferrell played John Tesh and Don Chess's brother who sings the lyrics.
Tim Robinson and Jason Sudeikis.
Oh, so sorry.
It's really funny.
It's so good.
If you haven't seen that, go watch it. It's great.
Yeah, just pause this and go watch that. Again, asbestos dust covering everything. Hank heads down into the bowels of the asylum, into these tunnels. He is going to go mark the ducts as a biohazard that they have to clean up. Then you put on a gas mask, which to me makes sense. Okay. Or at least the other areas you can have windows open, have some ventilation.
Yeah, if you're underground, you're just breathing it in.
Yeah. At lunch, Phil says, okay, we're off to a good start. And also, they promised to give us a $10,000 bonus. From what I understood, it's $10,000 each. But they have to be done by Monday. And Hank and Mike, who are old hands, are like, Gordon, this is at least a 2-week job. You know this. Why would you promise them a week?
Also, it would suck to, like, work so hard. Clearly, yes. You're going to work overtime, shitty hours, harder than you've ever worked, and then also miss the deadline and not
which
get
the bonus.
Which
is what I would assume if I was them. I'm like, even if we work 24 hours a day, we're going to fucking blow this. And also, there's only five of us, and one of us is new, you know?
Yeah.
The guard arrives. The guard made them keys for the main gate to let themselves in. And, you know, they're sort of talking about why the building got abandoned. He's like, well, you know, again, my wife is a historian, and it has a lot to do with deinstitutionalization following budget cuts. Sort of people were deinstitutionalized, and because it's America, we didn't really set up anything for them to be received into, nor did we fix any part of society that made us think, well, we'll just send anyone with a mental illness to some sort of facility so we don't have to deal with them. So these people were released in it, and Mike says, well, it was budget cuts, but it wasn't just that. There was also the Patricia Willard scandal of 1984, which would have been the year before it closed, right?
Yeah.
And of course, luckily, Mike knows the whole story. He's going to lay it out for us.
Thank God.
He says, Patricia was committed in the 1970s by her parents.
But in the 1980s, this new kind of therapy took off, repressed memory therapy. See, the shrinks figured that with these new techniques they designed, they could release hidden memories.
And under that, she unearthed memories in which she said that when she was 10, her father raped her 3 times a week. And it wasn't just rape. He would come into her room in a black robe, drive her to the woods where her grandparents and mother were waiting, also in robes, and they'd take them off and have group orgies. She would then watch as her mother would cut out the heart of a newborn and drink its blood, and others would eat its flesh.
No.
Meanwhile, Gordon is looking at his phone, and it says home on it. So, you know, he's, like, picturing his own, like, family.
Yeah, of course.
And Mike says, and finally, her father and grandfather would rape her and force her to get abortions and then cook it and eat the aborted fetuses. And Jeff's like, wait, did that happen? And Mike says, no, it was basically a repressed memory of satanic ritual abuse, which was part of the satanic panic. And it ended up being this huge scandal because that didn't happen. And there was no evidence of it. And in the end, Patricia ends up suing her family, like, after that comes out in therapy. And then her family essentially found a physical proving, quote, unquote, she was a virgin. I was like, maybe biologically you could prove that she had been pregnant multiple times, but I don't know how you'd prove it. I mean, like, what, her hymen's ripped? But, like, maybe that was the 80s. Yeah. Maybe that was, like, what was.
Different time.
Crazy. Yeah. But basically they're like, well, none of this happened and there's no evidence. And it seems like she has never been had sex, let alone been pregnant. But I mean, it's like, this abuse would have some sort of physical toll considering the brutality and repetitive nature of it. So I'm not saying like, oh, if you're pregnant, everyone can tell afterwards. I'm just saying like, this seems like the most extreme version of which there would be some kind of physical.
Something. Or,
you know, and maybe that's just like photographs, video, like even beyond the body.
A robe.
Yes. Yeah. A black robe. Exactly. In the end, there wasn't evidence of it. And the family sued the hospital and won. So Mike concludes, it was that. But it was also the budget cut. So that was sort of the last straw that, like, shut down Danvers. They all head back into work, and Hank teases Mike. It turns out that Mike knows about this because his dad's a state attorney and actually was on that case. But Mike dropped out of law school. So Mike sort of, he's like the black sheep of his family. Okay. And now he, like, works removing asbestos, and everyone's like, okay. Okay, college boy. Phil takes Gordon aside and says, me and Mike called you Saturday to get a drink to celebrate the job and the bonus, but you didn't answer. I just want to make sure everything's okay with you and Wendy, you know? And Gordon's like, I'm so sorry. I was trying to catch him in my sleep. I was dead to the world. You know, Emma's still got this ear infection. And he says, well, you know, while I was there, I met up with this other asbestos remover guy who works for American Freedom called Craig McManus. You know Craig. You know from around the asbestos removal game. Yeah. And, you know, he says if he'd be willing to join us, if we want to sub him in, and he's incredibly experienced, I think it would be really great to have him on the team. Mm-hmm. Gordon, of course, he assumes he's talking about Jeff because Jeff's new. He's like, Jeff is not as dumb as he looks. He's also young, so he has the energy. We just need to put him on stuff that requires a lot of energy, you know? Yeah. And Phil's like, I'm not talking about Jeff. I'm talking about Hank. But, of course, Gordon's like, okay, but Hank is good at this. It's just that you hate him because he stole your woman, you know?
Which is
fair. Yeah, but Phil says, Craig actually gives a shit. Like, that's what he brings to the job. And Gordon says, I appreciate you saying this. Your job is to keep the wheels on the project. I'm not firing Hank at this point. He's already on it. So let's set up the decon chamber, and we'll just keep going forward. But we'll keep Craig in mind for future jobs, right? And Phil says, that's fine. But, of course, Phil's upset. We see Hank go back into the basement. He's down there looking around. Jeff is driving a floor cleaner over the tiles. And this is when I realized, like, I was trying to pay attention of like what progress they were making. Mm-hmm. And it's actually impossible to say over the course of the movie. And I'm assuming that's intentional. Like, we never see a finished room. We never see anything get totally resolved. And I'm assuming that was a stylistic choice. Because when you see it, you're like, I would like to see this all spick and span.
Yeah. What's it look like all cleaned up?
We never will see that. Because it much like the human mind, certain things cannot be put back in place. There are certain ills that cannot be resolved with just a floor cleaner and an asbestos cleanup team. Jeff is driving the floor cleaner around, and it dies suddenly, and Mike, of course, checks the plug and says, Jeff, this is a fuse issue. You're going to have to go to the basement and check the breaker box. And Jeff says, I can't do that. I have nyctophobia. Allison.
What is that?
What is nyctophobia? It is an extreme irrational fear of the night or of darkness.
Oh, I was going to guess tubes for some reason.
Ooh, okay.
You know?
I could totally see.
But yeah, night also.
Yeah. Like falling in a tube, maybe?
Yeah.
Thank you. Okay. Mike says...
Being in a tube? Yeah.
Mike is like, okay, that's fine. I'll go. I don't even know what that is. He's able to get the lights back on in the basement. Allison, he turns around and sees the open door of a room behind him. It says staff only. So you know he's going in there.
Yeah, you gotta.
And he enters what appears to be a file room, but everything's overturned. There's like boxes on the floor. The light flickers, and he looks up to see a sealed box labeled evidence. And of course, he does the most natural thing, which is open it with a box cutter.
Okay.
I'm like, there's
a box cutter in play?
There is nothing. Everyone has like little implements. Like everyone has a knife. Everyone has like, there's a lot of weapons on hand, which will obviously come into play, of course. So he opens that bad boy up. And we don't see it exactly, but he reveals eventually recordings of the sessions of a patient, which we'll find out in a minute. At the end of the day, the men start trickling out of the building. Hank has got dust in his eye. And then I'm like, if you get dust in your eye once, does that mean you get asbestos in your body forever?
Yeah, I'll be honest. I don't know a ton about asbestos. Me either. And how it works and how it affects us and like how it decomposes and kills. I don't know. But that seems like you don't want that.
I only know about mesothelioma because they had all of the commercials about it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Ads for it. Get your mesothelioma today.
2-for-1.
They're all getting ready to go. And Phil tells Gordon, you know, Mike's going to stay. He's going to fix the Jenny carburetor. It's the generator's acting crazy. So he's going to stay, but he knows we're leaving and he's good to go. And Gordon says, okay, because I don't want anyone in the building after dark. It's not safe. Which is true, but also I thought for sure they'd have to work for midnight till midnight.
Yeah.
I was like, you're going to do this all in a 12-hour day? I just don't.
Day hours?
There's just no way. So they all take off. They wave to Mike as he's working on the generator. As soon as they go, he goes back inside. And we see Mike again. He dropped out of law school, but he has like the inquisitive mind. You know, he wants to figure out what this is. He pulls out one of those like reel-to-reel tape players out of the evidence box.
Yeah.
And we see that there are tapes from 9 sessions. He puts the first one on and we hear a psychiatrist talking to a woman who's sobbing. She says that she misses Peter. And Mike looks at the file that's included and says, Mary Hobbs alters the princess, Billy, Simon, diagnosis DID, dissociative identity disorder. So doctor's talking to the patient, Mary, and he says, Mary, I want you to remember what happened 22 years ago on Christmas night in Lowell. Mary's still crying. She says, nothing happened. Doctor says, that's why we're here. Something did happen. That's why we have these sessions to help you remember, okay? Because if you remember, I think you'll be able to get well. So we know something happened 22 years ago on Christmas in Lowell.
Okay.
Mike looks, and we see, again, the last one being session 9. You know we're going to get to it at the end of the film. Suddenly, on the tape, Mary's voice turns into a little girl's voice, the princess.
Okay.
So, little girl, he's talking to a little girl's voice, like, Mary got a China doll from her mom, and we couldn't find it. The doctor says, Princess, could you tell me what happened 22 years ago on Christmas in Lowell? And Princess says, oh, there were presents. Mary got a China doll. And Peter got a big old knife. You're like, okay. So that's kind of where I thought we were going with this. He says, me and Billy were playing upstairs. And Mary and Peter were playing downstairs. Peter was playing hide and seek. And Mary turned out the light. And we see the other guys in their homes, which again, what I really liked is like a very humanizing, but again, not scary, but like dramatic choice of like, we see these guys at their lives. So it's like Jeff taking a shower. We see Phil drinking alone at a bar as we hear this, the recording. And the doctor says, okay, so Billy was there. Mary was there. Peter was there. And you were there, Princess. Was Simon there?
Okay.
Who is a third alter listed. And Princess says, I don't know any Simon. Outside his house, we see Gordon get home and he stares at the front window in the rain, looking devastated. And he looks down at his pant leg and there's blood seeping up from his leg through the fabric. And he winces in pain.
No.
Allison, Tuesday.
Why is he bleeding?
Well, nothing, no good reason. You know this.
Yeah, not for fun.
Tuesday, they're back at it again at dawn. Gordon is taking a break and he looks out a window. I thought it was a little gazebo. I'm going to say it's a gazebo for now. A little gazebo with crosses painted on it. And he keeps being drawn to it over and over again. Allison, in his head again, he hears the man's voice he heard when he first entered the building.
Oh, no.
And the voice says, you can hear me. Allison, what would you do?
What would you do?
I am abandoning this job. I'm never coming back here, and I'm moving myself to another state.
Yeah, I just feel like if you were to tell someone, it would suck, but people would understand. Like, this is not a, I'm going to ruin my family and my health and my, like, business
it's
over
this.
It's
not worth it.
You know what I mean? It's not worth it.
Even if you got it done and got the bonus, it's not worth $10,000. That's not enough money for what is clearly going to happen.
Right, yeah. And that's the bonus. So we don't know what the actual bid is. So it could be a lot of money. Like, I don't know. Like, if you're an asbestos person, maybe you only work twice a year because this is such an insane job that only specific people could do. Like, I could see that maybe. So maybe that is more the pressure. Like, this is going to be a huge part of my yearly
income. But nothing
income.
Is worth what I assume is happening in this.
It sure isn't. And if he knew what was going to happen, he would know that. But of course, he doesn't. That's the problem with being in a horror movie.
Yes, you don't know.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at kosai.org.
Gordon snaps out of it when he hears Phil banging on some ceiling tiles to bring them down. We see Jeff back again in the dining room with Mike. And Jeff says, what's with Hank and Phil's weird dynamic? Like, they're really in each other's face all the time. And Mike says, Hank stole Phil's girlfriend, Amy. We then see Hank downstairs. He's spraying red slime on the affected ducts. Allison looks down and he sees a quarter. And Hank's no slouch. He's picking that quarter up.
Clearly.
He looks at it and it's dated to 1884. And then he sees another quarter, 1883. Holy shit. He's thinking this might be worth something. And he goes into a corner and he sees a brick in the wall. There's sort of coins emerging from behind it. And he's able to pry it out and there's hundreds of quarters come pouring out of the hole. And not just quarters, like gold coins, rings, different kinds of jewelry come dumping out. And he picks up the ring, and it looks like it may have a, I'm going to say an evidence tag still on it.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
And he puts it on, Allison. Phil radios down and says, Hank, I need you to be upstairs with Mike and Jeff for the afternoon. And Hank says, sure. But he's trying to figure out, like, how do I take all this shit? Because I'm going to take it, right? Mm-hmm. And he puts the brick back in so, like, people at least can't see that part of it. And, of course, we reverse on the brick. Allison, we are inside the hospital's crematorium.
Oh, boy.
And those are the coins and the jewelry and the belongings of people who were cremated in this furnace, right?
Yes.
Gordon buys them lunch, and we see Phil took his wallet to buy them all scratcher tickets. So Phil hands Gordon back his wallet, and they all do the scratcher tickets. Mike is the only one still inside because Mike, and that's the problem, is like Mike is actually the worst at his job because he keeps sneaking away to listen to the session tapes, but we need him to in order to move the plot along. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
This time we get Billy, who's a little boy with like a little southern accent. And he tells the doctor, Princess lives in the tongue because she's always talking. And I live in the eyes because I see everything. And the doctor says, okay, well, where does Simon live? Billy doesn't reply. Outside, Jeff shows them that he found a logbook from the 1880s, like just in a room. And he's reading all the diagnoses. And to me, I was a queer person. I'm like, these diagnoses are all basically like, this person's gay or trans. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, this person is fucked up in a way that society.
Clearly, that's what it,
And he says, what's mortified pride? These patients were committed for mortified pride. Like, all these, like, what does that mean in a modern day word, you know? And he says, 17 were commuted for disappointed expectations, which I love. And Jeff says, well, what would you have to do to get committed to something like this now? And Hank says, you just got to kill somebody. John Hinckley? I mean, he pled temporary sanity and he got committed. He didn't go to prison. And Mike, of course, knowing from his lawyer father, says, most people, that doesn't work. Like, that plea doesn't work even when it is true. But he says, I believe most people are cognizant of their actions when they kill. And Jeff starts making fun of him. He's like, oh, you know all about it. Well, you have a lobotomy too? And they're eating Chinese food and he drinks a container of like milky white soup. And I'm like, is it like egg drop soup? And he sort of like squelches it out of his mouth because he's still basically a child. And he goes, lobotomy. And Mike grabs him and holds a chopstick up to Jeff's eye.
Jesus.
And he says, that's the thing about Danvers. It's where they perfected the ice pick lobotomy. That's how it works. Or it didn't work. And he sort of walks through basically like...
Insert a thin metal pipette into the orbital frontal cortex and enter the soft tissue of the frontal lobe. A few simple, smooth up and down jerks to sever the lateral hypothalamus.
And then, of course, either that would relieve your symptoms or it would leave you with a permanent brain damage or potentially both. And he lets Jeff up and Jeff kind of jumps up and runs away. And Gordon's watching this whole scene with this very peculiar, worried face on his, look on his face, which is why I love this actress so much, is you keep catching him. It's not just a worried look. It's a different shade of worry in every scene. It's so well done. And because, like, he's obviously not going to tell anyone about the fact he keeps hearing that voice.
Yeah.
But then they are in this environment that it's like, is this making me crazy? And I'm not sleeping because of the baby and all the stress from work. And we're constantly surrounded by asbestos. You could see how he's rationalizing the voice into the rest of it.
Yes.
Hank and Jeff and Mike work in the dining room. Hank tells Jeff, you know what a whale is? A whale is a big time gambler. My friend works at Foxwoods, and this whale comes in, and he has a house down $300,000. And when he walks out, he goes up to my friend, and he drops the keys to his car in my friend's pocket. He gave him his car. It was a Porsche 911. It's like, that is quite a name for a car. And Jeff says, well, okay, but what's your point? How do we do that? And Hank says, my point is just you got to have an exit plan. Because this job, you don't want to be doing it when you're our age. This will wear you down. This is back-breaking work, more so than even construction. And he snaps off a piece of tile. Also, Hank, while he's talking about this, does not have his mask on. He breaks off a piece of tile. You could literally see the dust come out of it.
What?
And he's holding it up and he says, think of this. A microscopic particle of this could already be in your lungs. It's like, well, don't snap it off.
Then what are you doing? Proving a point? Like,
put your mask on, bitch. And that's what Jeff says. Like, well, you don't have your mask on. He's like, oh, it's too late. That's why I have to have an exit plan. He said, everyone here has an exit plan. Mike, he doesn't read all those books for nothing. He's going to get another job. He's going to get out of here. You know, he talks about Phil. He's got his stress reliever. He's got his plan. Maybe he'll tell you about it one day. Meanwhile, we see Mike has gone downstairs for a piece of equipment. And he finds that the red biohazard paint has spilled onto the ground, covering a fresh bouquet of roses. Again, that would be enough for me to bring it to the other guys and be like, what is this?
Yeah.
Because it implies somebody brought it in.
Right. Those aren't like from 15 years ago.
Exactly. Like, but of course, now Hank is holding court and he says, well, you know, Gordon, Gordon, your uncle, he's the Zen master of calm. But he doesn't have a backup plan. That's his problem. This is his career. This is his life. And the last couple of months, I've seen him some real crack show. Right now, Mike comes back in. He's like, he just had a baby. Like, when you and Amy have a kid, you'll see how hard those first months are. And Hank's like, me and Amy, we're not going to have a kid. I'm just fucking her to get to Phil. It's like, that's the straightest thing anyone has ever said.
Yes.
Fucking his ex
Fuck you.
To annoy yeah. Phil? Like, what are you talking about? Upstairs, we see Gordon arguing on the phone with Wendy. He says, we have to talk because we have to. Would you let me fit? Hello? And Wendy has hung up on him. So obviously something has happened between them yes. at home. Wendy is not taking his calls. Outside, he sees Phil pretty clearly buying drugs from two guys. So again, I think we're going to think that's his stress reliever.
Yes.
He's also out every night drinking. So these two like young guys are buying drugs from him. And they saunter off when they're done. That night, a car arrives at the hospital after dark. After all the guys have gone home, it is Hank. He's come back. I don't know, he's got a bucket, and he's coming back to load up on coins and other things from the basement. Basically, so he can go gambling. Like, he's clearly going to just go to the casino and go nuts. He also finds a lot of stuff down there, like watches, coins. He also finds indentures. He is not fazed by this. He's just pawing through the dust, finding treasures. He finds a bag of glass eyes. He's also listening to
Not in a bag.
In a little bag. Yeah, a little bag. And he said, oh, these are probably worth something. And that is true. No, you could sell that online.
I guess. Yeah. A bag of glass eyes?
Yeah. He's listening to a Discman, which I remember having in high school and loving.
Me too.
And he said there's a thud behind him. He's like, I think my time here is gone. So he gets up. He starts walking into the tunnel. He's about to leave and go into the tunnels. And he, for the last sort of grab, he reaches into the furnace and picks up something. And it pricks his hand, and when he brings it up, it's a real find. It's an actual ice pick designed for ice pick lobotomies.
No.
Which, again, people would pay money for that, though. So I'm sure he's like, I will pay the—I think eBay existed by then, 2000? Or around then. So I'm sure he's like, I could really get some money for this. So he loads up everything, and he then heads down the darkened hallway. He's got a flashlight. The lights aren't on, obviously, because the generator's not running. And he's walking down the hallway, and he finds an empty jar of peanut butter on the floor. To be fair, they've been told that people squat there all the time. It's also massive. Like, there could be people in the other wing. They'd have no idea. Like, it's such a sprawling piece of real estate. He picks up the jar, and he hears something behind him.
No.
He whips around. Obviously, there's something there. He goes to walk on. Another clatter. Happens a third time. A figure appears at the end of the hall. Hank wisely books it. And he's just screaming and running until something flies at him.
Correct.
And it's a pigeon. And he says, fucking birds, which I'm right there with him.
Yep. Oh, God. No one hates them more than us.
Allison, he sees the exit sign. He's so close. And as he walks, it's a great shot where he's walking toward the exit. And we see for the POV of somebody else walking down another hallway towards him. So we see the moment when Hank turns and the look of surprise on his face. Cut to Wednesday. Everyone's hard at work, busting up tile, breaking up, you know, the ceiling tiles. In the basement, we see the hole in the wall. There are no coins at all. There's nothing, no evidence that there are anything. It's not like he could take all of it. You know what I mean?
Right.
There's nothing to suggest anything was ever there. All the guys take a break on the roof. No one can get through to Hank, right? So he just didn't show up. Phil's, of course, like, I told you this guy is unreliable. You know this about Hank. Of course he was going to fucking do this. Jeff says, could you please call Amy? Like, let's just call her.
Yeah.
And Phil demands Gordon's phone to call with. And he's like, I know the number by heart. I'll just call her. He calls Amy. We hear his side of the conversation. And when he hangs up, he says, okay, Hank came to her place last night, packed up his bags, took the car, and then drove to Miami because he said he's going to casino school.
Casino school?
I was like, I guess to be like a dealer? That'd be a fun job.
Yeah.
And Phil's like, I told you he's a fucking flake. Gordon, you should have fired him 6 months ago. And Jeff's like, whoa, I wonder if he won that scratcher yesterday. Because they did do scratches and then, like, nobody showed each other. He's like, damn, did he get a little bit of money? Phil says, let's call Craig McManus. He can replace Hank tomorrow and do a better job than him anyways. But Gordon's looking at that gazebo with the crosses again. So, like, something is not right here. And he turns to Phil and he says, who are those guys you were talking to yesterday? Because clearly Gordon's now thinking, you hated Hank. You wanted him off the job and you hate that he's fucking Amy. Did you talk to some guys about killing him or scaring him out of town?
Threatening him, yeah.
Like, did you threaten him? Of course, Phil's like, oh, I can't even believe that you would suggest that. And starts to walk away and Gordon snaps and screams at him in front of the other guys, Don't you walk away from me. And Phil turns and says, well, then hit me. But Gordon's not going to do that. And he storms inside to go stew on the stairs. Allison, when he looks at his hands while he's stewing on the stairs, his nail beds are coated in dry blood. At lunch, we see Phil is also pouting. He's like, you know, Gordon didn't want to be a father. That was all Wendy's idea. And now he is, and it's making him soft and bad at his job. He should have fired Hank 6 months ago. I told him he was a flop. And now he's fucking us over. Meanwhile, Mike is down. And Mike is looking at the book that Jeff found of, like, from the 1800s and says, yeah. You know, eight people were committed for uncontrolled passion. That seems gay. There's some that feels like a gay person diagnosis.
That really reads as gay.
You know, and Mike's trying to be rational. It's like plenty of people say they don't want to have kids, and then when they have kids, they love them. Or they change their mind about having kids. That's so crazy. 6 years ago, you know, I thought I didn't want to be a lawyer, but like now I'm kind of back on it. And Phil says, you're bullshitting yourself. Your life is in there shucking fiber with us. Shucking fiber?
Shucking fiber.
I love it. Mike storms away.
It's a little more kicky and fun.
Yeah. There's a lot of people storming away. Mike storms back down into the file room, and he finds Mary Hobbs's file. It was under number 444. So he's finding more intel about Mary Hobbs, right? Meanwhile, Gordon, he's been really drawn to this gazebo, and he gets there. It's not a gazebo. It's like the entrance to a set of wooden stairs down to the cemetery.
Of course. Why wouldn't it be?
The grounds are gorgeous. I was like, this is beautiful. He finds a fallen tree to sit on and call Wendy. And he says on the phone, can you ever forgive me? And as he talks, we pan down to see he is sitting on Mary Hobbs's tipped over grave, number 444. Jeff interrupts him and Gordon like hangs up really quickly. And Gordon is on the verge of tears. And Jeff can tell, but Jeff's thinking like, oh, is it about the job? Is it about Hank? You know, like, and Jeff's like, just want to check in on you. You know, my dad got the photos back from the christening, and Emma looks really pissed. And Gordon's like, yeah, she really did. Like, clearly his life is falling apart. He's like, yeah, my baby did look bad.
Just holding back.
Thank you for telling me. And down in the file room, Mike listens to another session tape, and the doctor says, where did you get your scars, Mary? And she's sobbing. She tells him, I already told you from when I fell off my bike as a girl. Allison, we see a photo of the scars. They are, in fact, a bunch of stab scars on her breastbone. And slashes to her wrist. And the doctor says, is that what you remember, Mary, a bicycle accident? She says, yes. And he asks her again, do you know who Princess Billy or Simon are? And she's like, I keep telling you, I don't know who you're talking about. Billy then cuts in. He says, okay, Billy, let's get down to brass tacks. Why won't you tell me what happened 22 years ago on Christmas in Lowell? And Billy says, well, because you know very well what happened. The doctor says, yes, I do know, but we have to tell Mary. Mary has to know, because if Mary's allowed to consciously know it, that will help her be well. And if you don't want to tell me, maybe Simon will. And Billy goes, no! In the decom shower, Phil and Gordon are getting cleaned up at the end of the day, hosing themselves off. And Gordon says, what is your biggest regret, Phil?
Light post-work chat.
Phil's like, well, I would say right now, introducing Hank to Amy. That was a pretty huge one. But also, I'm sorry, like, if you're girlfriend just needed to meet one other man.
You guys weren't gonna last anyway.
She was going, Phil. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Finally, Gordon reveals like what he's been sort of in a panic about. He says, I hit my wife. And he tells a story. He said, I got home Friday and I wanted to celebrate. I was getting the bid. That's why I had the flowers and the champagne and the treats. He said, when I walked in to kiss her, she had a pot of boiling water on for dinner. And she turns, and the pot of boiling water dumped onto my leg. And between that and the dog barking and Emma crying, I slapped Wendy across the face. She obviously kicked me out, and I'm staying at a hotel, and she's refusing to talk to me. And Gordon's like, as a friend, please do not tell the other guys. I just had to tell you, like, that's why I've been acting like this. And Phil's like, okay, well, then I'll talk to you about my thing, the kids the other day. And, of course, Gordon's like, we're selling you drugs. And Phil says, no, I was telling them not to do graffiti on the grounds. And if they come back, I'll call security, which is obviously horseshit. Yeah. But Gordon's like, okay, man.
Sure. If that's the story you want to tell, fine.
Yeah. And Gordon says to him, like, okay, you were right about Craig McManus. Would you please call him and see if he can come tomorrow? Because, like, if Hank's gone, there's nothing we do about it. Yeah. At night, we see Gordon wake up, and it is a nightfall. He's actually fallen asleep in the driver's seat of his van. Allison, we hear again a man's voice say, hello, Gordon.
No.
You know who I am.
No.
And we see a flash of Wendy holding Emma. We hear Wendy thanking him for the roses. And we hear the boiling water overturn. Ooh. And Wendy screaming, like, in a panic.
Yeah.
And then we see, obviously, it's Gordon in his mind. We see a man in a hazmat suit standing in Danvers, covered in blood, standing in the hallway. And the man's voice says, "Do it, Gordon." And we hear the sound of the slap. And sort of Gordon, like, jerks too.
Okay.
And he groans as he pulls up his pant leg. And we see why he was bleeding. He has this horrible, bubbling burn wound on his thigh from the water. And we see him pour iodine over it and scream.
I, like, have a physical reaction to that.
And Allison, that night, we see a figure hobbling through the hospital in the dead of night. On the screen, Thursday. In the morning, at dawn, Gordon pulls up next to Phil, who is also going through a lot. Everyone's going through a lot.
Everybody's got stuff going on.
And he tells Gordon, Craig can start tomorrow. We couldn't start today, but he can come Friday. So we'll take his work, you know. And Phil says, "How are you doing?" And Gordon, who is not doing well, he says, "I want to go home." But they can't. There's asbestos to remove. You can't, literally can't go home to do any of this work.
You
can't go home.
You have to finish this.
The fuses keep blowing. So, you know, before Mike can go downstairs, Phil interrupts him and pulls him into the hall. And so they send Jeff down to the fuse box, which Jeff doesn't want to do because it's dark. And he's like, "I have nyctophobia." Phil does not care about that. Yeah. And he sends Jeff down into the dark. In the hall, Phil immediately tells Mike about Gordon hitting his wife. He says, "Gordon is falling apart, so we need to see what we can do, whether that's him taking time off, because if we don't finish by Monday, we will lose the gig and we will lose our bonus." And I do think there's something where it's like, at this point, like, throw the bonus at two other guys who remove asbestos. Like, it is, if this is even conceivably possible to get it done, you have to spend more money to get more guys.
Yeah.
I don't know why I'm so invested in the business part, but they do a good job being like, well, you have to figure it out.
It's nice when, like, they're, like, it's not the subplot. It's, like, technically, like, the main plot is, like, fleshed out enough where you're, like, I see why we're where we are.
And it's very satisfying. I think this job does a good, movie does a good job of, like, I like every character. They give enough life to every character.
Yes.
Like, Mike's with the session tapes and, you know, Hank is a gambler who also, like, is an asshole. And, like, Jeff's a sweetie pie. Like, they did an excellent job in, and not that I don't hate a movie where the characters are all flat and, like, there's a slasher.
Right.
But it does make me invest more. And I do feel bad for poor Gordon. He's done something horrific, and it is destroying him, as it should.
Yes.
You know. Of course, Gordon is hearing this. He's literally standing at the bottom of the steps, hearing Phil tell Mike that he hit Wendy. And he's like, "That's the one thing I asked you to please not do." So then he walks up. There's, like, this moment of Mike and Phil being like, "Did he hear me?" Ooh. And Phil turns around, and Gordon is walking towards them. Mike says, "Oh, we were just talking about how Jeff, he's really coming along, you know." Gordon's like, "Oh, okay." Meanwhile, Jeff is down in the basement. He flips the breaker. But then as he walks up the stairs, he sees Hank wearing sunglasses, standing in a stairwell, you know, talking to himself. And Jeff says, "Hank, what are you doing?" And Hank, looking out the window, says, "What are you doing here? What are you doing here?" Jeff says, "I'm working. What are you doing here?" And all Hank can say, "What are you doing here?"
Hey.
And he reaches up and he wipes his hand on the window, and his hand is covered in blood.
Oh.
Jeff, reasonably enough, runs back to the other guys, screaming. And we see Gordon flip a coin to see whether he or Mike have to go get lunch. And we see the coin spin just then as Hank drops one of the coins he found onto the ground up on the stairwell.
Okay.
And we see Phil grab the coin. Jeff runs up to them and is like, "I found Hank, and I don't know if he's doing okay." But Phil refuses to believe him. He's like, "I talked to Amy. She said he went to Miami. You're delusional."
But it's like, what's the harm in going and seeing?
Also, Amy could be lying. Amy could have thought he left. He could have told her he was leaving. And then shacking up with another woman.
Right.
Right. Like, he could be up here looting the hospital and just was like, "Fuck you guys. I don't care about this anymore." But of course, when they go back up there, Jeff is in a panic. But needless to say, Hank is not there.
Yeah.
Phil is basically like, "I fucking told you. Amy said he was in Miami. You all heard her say it." And Gordon says, "No, you told us she said it. We didn't hear her. You were on the phone. None of us heard her." And Phil's like, "Well, she told me." And Gordon says, "Give me my cell phone." And I think that is, like, his work phone that, like, everyone can use. He's like, "Give me the phone and I'll call her myself." Phil flips out. He says, "See, Mike, he's losing it. Don't give him the phone." If somebody says they're losing it, don't give them the phone, that person is in the wrong. Like,
yeah.
There's no proof more positive than they're crazy. Don't let them make the one phone call that would prove whether or not I'm being insane right now.
Yeah.
Well, then you should make the call, right? Gordon again flips out and screams, give me the fucking cell phone. Allison, just then, they hear someone running over their heads on the next floor up.
Oh, no.
Phil has the fucking stones to say, what was that? And Jeff screams, it's Hank. It's obviously Hank. You stupid bitch. Gordon yells at Phil to come with him upstairs to find Hank, and he tells Jeff and Mike to go to the exits to catch him if he tries to leave. But Phil says, fuck you. I'm not going with you after you doubt me like this. I'm taking Jeff. We'll do the exits. Mike, you go with Gordon. And everyone's like, okay. Mike and Gordon run upstairs while Phil and Jeff run to the door. Jeff starts to run outside and basically like run around to the other exit. And Phil says, no, let's take the tunnels. It'll be safer.
That's literally never been true.
To which Jeff recently replies, safer? But it's already too late. Phil is running down into the tunnels and Jeff follows behind him. And as they walk up on the third floor, Mike says, did you hear that? I thought I heard something down in the tunnels. Allison, at this point in the movie, who will survive?
Who will survive?
I'm going to guess nobody except for who is coming on Friday, Craig?
Craig McManus.
I'm going to guess Craig is the only survivor.
You think Craig's going to walk up and be like, here's my job. Oh my God, this place is a mess. There's no way I'm going to make the bid now.
Yeah, that's my guess.
Yeah, sorry, Craig. I don't think you're getting paid for this job.
No, I don't think anybody is.
No, getting paid in heaven or hell, depending on how things go from here on out.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at kosai.org.
Gordon says, what do you mean in the tunnels? Mike says, I'm going to go out of the tunnels. You follow up top. You stay up here. I'm going to go in the tunnels, right? However, Mike is not trying to trick him or anything. Mike says, fuck this. I'm going to go listen to the session tapes. Allison, it is time for session 9.
The original podcast.
Yes. Meanwhile, Phil is also in the tunnels. Phil tells Jeff, did you hear that? And they look down, there's like a laddered opening to a sub-basement, Allison. A sub-basement of a abandoned mental institution.
No, no, no.
They look down a laddered opening and they can hear Hank's Walkman playing in the tunnel below.
Mm. That's not great.
Phil says, stay up here, I'll call you on the walkie. Of course, Jeff left his walkie in the van. But Phil starts going down the ladder and he says, I just want to warn you, when I saw Hank, I think he had blood on his hand. Phil's like, okay, great. And he goes down to try to find him. On the session tape, session number 9, we hear the doctor tell Billy, if Mary is sick, then all of you are sick too. So to help Mary get better, you have to remember what happened that night in Lowell. Yeah. And we see in her file, it's written out, it says, the altar Simon, the first manifestation of him appeared during, quote, the tragedy. And Billy's crying. He says, Mary's a good girl. She doesn't need to know what Simon did to Peter. We see a family photo. We see like a 14-year-old Mary and her slightly older brother, Peter. Upstairs, we hear the man's voice calling Gordon. And when Gordon follows it, he sees ripples of footsteps and like water on the floor. So he's like, oh, there's somebody here. It must be Hank. So he starts to pursue the voice through the floor.
Okay.
Allison, Phil finds Hank's Discman. And then later, further in the basement, he can hear Hank saying, what are you doing here? What are you doing here?
Yes.
And to Phil's credit, he starts going towards Hank to try to see if he'd help him.
Okay.
Jeff has also made his way down into the tunnels, presumably not knowing what else to do.
Yeah.
As he does, the generator outside conks out and they're all plunged into darkness. And there's this great effect of suddenly, this wouldn't happen, like the lights would all go out once, but the lights start going off one by one and Jeff starts trying to outrun the darkness.
Incredible.
In a total panic, it's a great sequence. He doesn't succeed because that's not how darkness works, obviously. Phil does find Hank. He is naked except his underwear and his sunglasses on. He's in like a dead end corner of one of the tunnels and he's just saying over and over again, what are you doing here? What are you doing here? Just then Phil hears on his walkie, Gordon saying from the higher floor, I think I found Hank. We see Gordon walking down another hallway and he sees the wheelchair we saw at the beginning at the entrance of the hospital that we've seen a couple times. And Phil walkies him and says, where are you? Gordon tells him, I'm Ward A, third floor. I'm following someone. I think it's Hank. The generator luckily starts up again. Just as Jeff like makes it to the end of the tunnel and we see sunlight streaming in, Allison just billows of asbestos dust. Ugh. He's coughing it in and out of his lungs. That was as terrifying as anything in this.
That is fucked up.
Yeah. Having had Hank scare him about it, to see it then, you know, it's coughing out of his lungs, awful. Oh, also, Hank describes what mesothelioma is, which is asbestos gets into your lung tissue. And then because the tissue can't reject it, like it can't get rid of it, it starts to grow around it like a pearl. Like if a piece of sand gets into a clam, like, or an oyster. It's like, and then flesh starts to grow around it. And then it basically your lungs stop working because it's like they're so full of these like nodules.
Yeah.
So we got that going for us. Allison, this time the tape starts playing again. And this time there is a voice we haven't heard before. Well, except we have. It is Simon's voice. It is, of course, the man's voice we've been hearing throughout the film speaking to Gordon.
Okay.
And Simon says on the tape, do you know who I am? And the doctor says again, I'm going to cut the shit here. What happened 22 years ago on Christmas night in Lowell? Simon tells the doctor, Peter was naughty. He shouldn't have done it, Doc. He crept up behind Mary in the dark. And she dropped her china doll. The shards cut her up real bad. She needed someone to help her in that moment. So I introduced myself. And I told her to cut up Peter. We see Phil walking upstairs to find Gordon.
Okay.
Allison, Phil is holding a curved knife.
Okay.
We see Gordon enter the room with the photo collage that we saw at the beginning. And of course, we see on the door, it's Mary Hobbs's room.
Okay.
And we see like the wall covered in 70s images of her staying there. He turns around. On the far wall is a similar collage made entirely out of photos of Emma's christening, smeared with the red slime paint.
What?
Gordon turns around just as Phil steps into the room. And we cut to Jeff running outside of the basement, sobbing, pulling off his jumpsuit, like there's dust everywhere. And Jeff runs to the to get his walkie-talkie from the van. And we see him while he's doing it, he reaches into the door pocket and pulls out the box of Oreos we saw Gordon take into the house.
To the house.
So he's like eating Oreos while he's like sobbing in the walkie-talkie.
Okay.
And he calls Gordon on the walkie-talkie and a voice replies and says, who is this? Jeff's like, well, it's Jeff. We then get this incredible POV. We see Jeff turn around and it has like a look of relief. And as we approach him from the killer's POV, he says, I'm sorry, I got so scared. Can I eat these? And he reaches out his arms for a hug. And he gasps as the camera zooms towards him. Allison, it is Friday.
Okay.
We are back at it. And in the basement, we see the tape player is still on, and it's just flipping. We just hear the end of the tape flip, 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 flip. Gordon is in his van, and Phil calls him from inside. It says, come back. We found the one. We found the one responsible. And we see Gordon put his cell phone into his cell phone holster and go inside. Allison, luckily, just in time, a black car whips into the parking lot. And it's just exactly who you want to see be named Craig McManus.
100%. I know. Like, I have an image of who Craig McManus is. And I bet it matches exactly who was cast.
Yeah, like mustache, like brown, sort of like longer hair, smoking a cigarette. And he's like, oh, hell yeah. Okay, I'm here to get some asbestos. He gets out. And because Gordon's van is red, he doesn't see that there's a bloody handprint on the passenger side door. Craig walks into the building and goes, hello? In the gym, we see there's a huge pool of blood on the floor. Gordon makes his way into sort of a cordoned off area that's covered in tarps. So tarps hanging. and he finds Hank's body covered in a tarp. And Gordon looks down and looks up to see Phil standing over the corpse. Phil says, look, he was a liability. He brought it on himself. Gordon says, you did this? Phil says, Gordon, I need you to wake up and like really take a good look at him, okay? And we see Gordon kneel down. He takes off Hank's sunglasses. Allison, the lobotomy ice pick is stabbed into the inner corner
Jesus
of Hank's eye.
Christ.
And he is not dead. Hank gasps awake. And he repeats the only thing he's been able to say, the last thing we've heard him say, which is, what are you doing here? What are you doing here, man? And Gordon, of course, is like, oh, my God. I'll kind of call 911. Don't worry. I've got you. He's still alive. He had, of course, assumed he was dead. And Phil says, well, the problem with that, Gordon, is that if you tell someone about this, they'll find out about the others. And he says, you did this. You hired those two guys to do this to Hank. I don't know what you think. And Phil, of course, interrupts and says, you got to wake up, Gordon. And Gordon screams, I am fucking awake. Just then, Craig fucking McManus waters in and doesn't immediately understand what's going on. Obviously.
Why would you?
He's like, hey, I'm here. And he walks all the way over to Gordon before he looks down. Presumably, there's just like a pile of tarps to see Hank's still slightly alive body. And I think Craig says basically like, I'm a little confused. And Gordon turns to look at Phil. Allison, there is no Phil there.
Okay.
And when Craig realizes, okay, something horrible is going on, Gordon grabs Craig and we hear Simon's voice encourage him, do it. We see Gordon reach down, pull the ice pick out of Hank's eye and stab it into the inner part of Craig McManus's eye, killing him.
Yeah.
And we hear on the session 9 tape Simon's voice. And the doctor's saying, well, why did you do it, Simon? And Simon tells the doctor, because Mary let me, Doc. They always do. And we cut back to the last scene where we saw Phil alive. Mm-hmm. And that scene was when he walked into the Mary Hobbs's room and told Gordon, I found Hank. He's hurt. And he's saying, you did it to him. And Gordon killed Phil then and there. He then also kills Mike in the gym. And the saddest death, he is, of course, the one who killed Jeff. And I feel bad because Jeff throws out his arms to hug his uncle. And he kills him with the hooked knife that Phil was carrying. We hear Phil's voice say, Gordon, it's time to remember. And we see Gordon walking into his house and the pot burning on the stove, boiling on the stove. And then we hear sort of, we're panning over the collage of family photos in that room. We hear the slap and then we hear it escalating. And eventually we hear Gordon stabbing Wendy to death as Simon encourages him, do it, Gordon, do it. Oh. As if that wasn't bad enough.
There's more.
We also hear him kill the dog.
Hey, that's tough.
And the dog's barking, cuts off, and then we are left, unfortunately, with baby Emma crying. And Simon tells him, do it, Gordon, do it. And Gordon does. And the crying stops. Back at the hospital, Gordon stares out the window of Mary Hobbs's room, of course, and calls Wendy again. And this time when we see his phone, we see it's all smashed. He's not calling
making
anybody.
Calls. Yeah.
He's not making calls. It's all smashed up. He says, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I'm so lonely here. I want to come home. I want to hold you. I want to hold my baby. Can you ever forgive me? And as we pan over the top of the stately abandoned Danvers State Hospital, we hear the end of the Session 9 tape where the doctor asks Simon, where do you live, Simon? And Simon replies,
I live in the weak and the wounded. Doc.
The end.
Okay.
Yeah. A great one.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
I kind of don't understand some stuff.
Great. Let's go through it.
Who is Simon?
Simon, I believe we're to think that Simon is a demon or some sort of entity.
That, like, was in Mary Hobbs. And so, like, did he end up in, and also all the names are the same, so, like, it was a little hard to keep track of something. Like, I'm like, Jeff 100%. And Phil are the same name. I don't know how to explain that.
There's also a Billy and a Bill, which is an insane thing. Like, not even a Will, but
Was listening to the tapes how Simon got into... Who killed everybody?
Gordon. I think that actually it was as soon as he came in the building because we hear
before he listens
a voice
to the tape,
say, hello, Gordon.
Okay. So it's just like...
That was like... Yeah.
But he had killed his wife after the first day. Okay. Yes. All right.
So I think we're to think
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
I take it as sort of similar to in The Shining, the book, where we're supposed, Jack has like a flaw within him. And that's sort of like in The Shining, it's that he broke his, or dislocated his son's shoulder, right? That there was something already in him that would allowed a space for something evil or supernatural to come in. Now, I do think it gets a little less compelling when it's like, okay, but Mary Hobbs was a 14-year-old girl, where it's like, okay, if she's mad at her brother, I don't know. But I think the idea is like, in that moment of rage at his wife, it's almost like, how do you allow yourself to hurt someone you love? It's almost like you have to give yourself permission. And I think Simon is like,
it's that kind of like, yeah.
Exactly. So yeah, so unfortunately, I think we're going to think that he killed his wife on that Friday night, and she had been dead this whole week. And he, of course, was mentally breaking down, but that Simon had already had control of him as soon as he entered the building because he had some sort of flaw within him that he was going to manipulate, basically.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That all makes sense. That's what I assumed, but yeah. I was like, well, I did confuse all question. Of these different men's names, so I'm not 100% sure who was up to what audially.
Yeah.
Okay, great. We could keep going.
Yep. So what are some fatal mistakes you think were made in the movie Session 9?
Fatal mistakes.
I mean, the rush job. Like agreeing to like do this intense, obviously impossible job of asbestos removal at a psychiatric hospital that clearly you can't do and obviously pushes everybody to their limits.
Yes. Absolutely. I think inventing and using asbestos was the number one mistake that people have made.
You know, like lobotomies and hospitalization for things that, are not helped by those things.
Right. Well, that's the thing is like, obviously like demon possession or whatever is not real, but if it was real, I don't think they would have been able to solve it in the hospital, right? Like that would not have been, Mary could not have gotten treatment for that is what I'm thinking. Yeah. So similarly, I don't know what anyone could have done to prevent Simon from taking possession of them or accessing them in that moment. So like that's not a mistake. It's really mostly the exposure to asbestos. And again, there are harder jobs than ours. And shout out to anyone whose job involves them having to interact with asbestos.
Yeah.
Terrifying shit. Absolutely horrible. But also thank you for your work. And then finally, where would you place Session 9 on the spooky scale, Allison?
A spooky scale.
I think this is a 7.
Okay, great.
I think the imagery of the hospital is obviously just like immediately chilling. I think like, the concept of asbestos as this thing that can kill you that's just floating in the air is like a nice, it's not just like, can you guys clean the floors? Like there's also this like added kind of danger that kind of keeps it all on edge. And then the rest of it's just really scary. Scary ending.
Yeah, love the ending. Perfect ending. I'm going to give it a 5. I would say 10 out of 10. I think it's a great movie. To me, it's sort of like Shutter Island. Where it is mostly sad, like obviously the family killing is horrific, but it's not scary. Like it's just like a, and that's why I think it's like more of a psychological. Yeah. I do think it's a psychological horror movie. It's not a thriller, like because there are horrifying moments designed to horrify in the moment. But I would say it's a great movie, but not necessarily one that I found particularly scary. But there is a mounting dread.
Yeah,
and
that's fun.
I love that all the characters were fleshed out. Like what a treat. To like be invested in really genuinely feel bad when they all get brutally murdered by an ice pick for the most part.
Me too.
What a great movie. I'm really glad that we finally did it. And that it was as good as it was like much more human and warm and character driven than people had given me the impression of or that I had taken
perfect
from them.
For this month.
But I really enjoyed it. I really liked it.
We're cruising through March Madness and yeah, I guess now all we have to do is ask you to please, if you wouldn't mind,
keep it spooky.
Keeping it spooky. Okay.
Thank you for doing so. Thank you. We really appreciate it.
Don't forget to follow us at Ruin Podcast and Crooked Media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok for show updates. And if you're as opinionated as we are, consider dropping us a review. Ruined is a Radio Point and Crooked Media production. We're your writers and hosts, Hallie Kiefer and Allison Leiby. The show is executive produced by Alex Bach, Sabrina Fonfetter, and Houston Snyder, and recorded and edited by Kat Iosa. From Crooked Media, our executive producer is Kendra James, with production and promotional support from Ari Schwartz, Kyle Sieglin, Julia Beach, Caroline Dunphy, and Awa Okolati.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at kosai.org.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Levi's, Plow and Hearth, Adidas, Sephora, and Neiman Marcus. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. And it's easy to use. And you get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's Rakuten. Rakuten.com.